This is the BBC in London. I'm Oliver Scott with NewsHour. 60 minutes of news, views and comment from around the world. The news headlines. Reports from Kenya say that with most votes counted after the general election, President Moi is poised to retain power. But after an exercise in democracy, which the country's biggest paper called a national disgrace, what lessons can both government and opposition now draw? Police patrols in Northern Ireland have been stepped up in an effort to prevent further sectarian killings. And a little later in the programme, we'll also be hearing from a mystified Gina Lollobrigida.
I must say I'm very popular with Arabs. I don't know why. Probably I am the right type for them.
All coming up later. First, the news read today by David Ryder.
The Kenyan president, Daniel Arap Moi, seems certain to win another term of office after an election marred by allegations of vote rigging. Unofficial results, based on three-quarters of the constituencies, give him a clear lead over his closest rival, a former vice president, Mwai Kibaki. Final results are not expected until the weekend. KANU has urged the opposition to accept defeat, and the government has warned that it will deal firmly with any lawlessness. Kathy Jenkins reports from Nairobi.
The unofficial results coming in from around the country now appear to show President Moi close to victory. He has a clear lead over his main rival, Mwai Kibaki, the leader of the Democratic Party. The ruling party, KANU, also appears to be doing well in the parliamentary poll, although analysts predict KANU's final tally of seats may fall short of what it wants. President Moi's advantage appears to have been helped by a strong showing in the west of Kenya, not normally a stronghold for him. Sensing victory on Thursday, KANU retreated from an earlier stance which had accused the Electoral Commission of rigging the poll against President Moi.
The former president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, has defied one of the terms of his house arrest by speaking to his supporters and journalists. Arriving at a court in Lusaka, where he is challenging the arrest order imposed early this week, he said President Chiluba was on trial, not him. Mr. Kaunda has been accused of involvement in an abortive coup last October, but he denies the allegation, saying Mr. Chiluba is waging a personal vendetta against him. The chief of the police force in Northern Ireland, Ronnie Flanagan, has announced that police patrols have been stepped up to prevent further sectarian attacks in the province. He was speaking after an emergency meeting with the British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Mo Molam. Mr. Flanagan said surveillance of bars, clubs and churches had been increased following the gun attack 2 days ago on a Roman Catholic bar in Belfast, in which one man was killed, the third murder in a week. John Lyon reports from Belfast.
This meeting comes at a time of growing concern for the Northern Ireland peace process. The task for the Northern Ireland Secretary and her security advisers is to prevent the recent outbreak of violence from leading into a general breakdown of the ceasefire still being observed by most paramilitary groups. A Protestant paramilitary group, the Loyalist Volunteer Force, has admitted carrying out the latest attack on a bar in North Belfast on New Year's Eve. But there's widespread suspicion that other Protestant paramilitaries may have been involved. Protestant paramilitary groups and the mainstream unionist parties committed to keeping Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom have been angered by what they see as excessive concessions being made by the British government to the IRA.
Scientists in Hong Kong are carrying out tests to see whether dogs, cats and rats may be carrying the virus which causes bird flu, the form of influenza spread by chickens. The animals have been tearing open refuse bags and eating the bodies of chickens slaughtered in an attempt to stop the spread of flu. There's been mounting criticism of the cull. Hong Kong's chief executive, Leung Chee Hua, has said there were failings in the way it was carried out. Here's Jill McGivering.
Mr. Tung admitted there had been inadequacies in the government slaughter of Hong Kong's chickens and said public concern about the way the operation was handled was justified. The operation to kill Hong Kong's chickens was supposed to take 24 hours, but 5 days later, thousands of chickens are reported to be still alive. Hong Kong residents have reported seeing live chickens wandering close to public housing estates. The birds are thought to have escaped from nearby farms after surviving the gas used in the slaughter. There have also been delays in disposing of the carcasses of slaughtered poultry. In some areas, rats, dogs and cats have been seen tearing open refuse bags and eating dead birds. This has sparked fears that the virus could spread through other animals which have had direct contact with infected chickens.
There have been further sharp falls in Southeast Asian currencies after New Year warnings from some regional leaders that economic problems will get worse before there's an improvement. The Malaysian ringgit and the Philippines peso fell to their lowest value yet against the dollar, and the Indonesian rupiah lost about 15% of its value during the day. French scientists have found a new genetic mutation, which they say helps make people resistant to HIV, the virus which can lead to AIDS. The discovery, reported by the British medical magazine The Lancet, follows research into why some people never become infected with HIV despite repeated exposure to infection. Another genetic mutation responsible for such resistance was identified 2 years ago. BBC World Service. Now back to Oliver Scott.
Kenya's head of state, Daniel Arap Moi, is poised to succeed himself as president for a further and final five-year term. This has become clear as vote counting has been going ahead following the presidential and parliamentary elections, marred by charges of fraud, corruption and violence. NewsHour's Greg Barrow has been out and about in the streets of the capital, Nairobi.
We're in Nairobi's central market where the fruit sellers, the butchers and the fishmongers are doing good business again just a few days after the election. Some of the stallholders are here. How are you finding these elections? Are you pleased with the way they've gone?
Just the same old thing. Because we've been having the same problems and I think they're just going to be the same.
And how does it affect business? You're all trying to make a business selling fruits and vegetables. How does that affect your business?
Business had already gone down and I think it's not going to peak because there's no money. No. If the economy is down, there's no business. See, once the economy is vibrant, everybody has a coin and everybody can purchase something. But now I don't think there's no change.
Is there anyone here who's happy? Is anyone I can ask here?
No. I don't think anybody's happy. They can't be happy because they're still in the same state. There's no improvement. Because if it was somebody who was coming, at least we'll get new jobs. I mean, new businesses opening up and somebody employing one more person for a hand, you know, creating jobs.
Well, there must be about 20 people around me now and none of you say that you voted for Kanu or President Moi. How does he get elected?
There was a lot of, you can say there was a lot of intimidation. They stole a lot and that delay brought in a lot of confusion and that's how they did their rigging. You see, if you have eyes and you have ears, you see and hear, you can see. This is something quite obvious. You don't need to be told. You just read between the lines, you see what has gone on.
Some of the views from the central market in the capital, Nairobi, which we have to remember is a strong opposition zone. I then went to KANU headquarters and asked the spokesman, Andrew Ligali, what a victory for President Moi and KANU would mean.
It means stability, it means a united Kenya, it means development. And we think that the president is the only person who can see us through the transition before he retires in the next 5 years so that we can know who will be able to take over from him.
What would the alternative have been like if this victory hadn't been secured?
We think that the alternative may well have been a disintegrated country because none of the other leaders really has the capacity to be able to bring Kenyans together. Kenyans have been used to the president. They know that he's the only one who transcends above all the various tribal inconsistencies. And we think that it's the right decision the Kenyans have made to keep President Moi in power for the next 5 years.
Well, the atmosphere down at KANU headquarters is obviously very positive. Victory celebrations have all but started. I then asked Richard Leakey, Secretary General of the opposition Safina Party, whether the KANU government is right to be so happy.
This government that we now seem to be getting is going to have an even more difficult time of governing than the one that it's theoretically replacing. The inflationary crisis, the lack of jobs, the lack of international confidence, the withdrawal of capital, the further demise of the infrastructure, the hospitals, the schools, the roads. This new government isn't going to be able to deal with that. And having won in an election that was at best a shambles doesn't give them the legitimacy to go to the international money markets. It doesn't give them the legitimacy to go to the donor countries and say, look, we're starting afresh, we want to move forward. It's business as usual. And if they are in the KANU headquarters gloating and patting themselves on the back, they are even more stupid than I would have given them credit for.
Richard Leakey there of the opposition party. Safina and Greg is on the line now from Nairobi. Greg, the opposition, as most people seem to agree, lost out because they're deeply divided amongst themselves. What can they do about this now?
Well, at this very late stage, they're actually talking about unity. It's been quite extraordinary that once they've realised what everyone had predicted for many years, that they would lose the election because they were divided, they're now, having done that, talking about getting together again. But really, they won't have another crack at the whip for another 5 years, so they've really lost the case.
Are there any lessons that the government can learn from what's happened after the nation's biggest newspaper called all this a national disgrace? And that's a pretty scathing condemnation, after all.
I think the government learned all of the lessons in 1992, and that is probably why the electoral process this time was so chaotic. Making it chaotic makes it easier to control and make sure the votes come into the right boxes. So there is a sense in which many people see the electoral process as somehow contrived to be chaotic to make it easier to move the vote in one direction or another. The government knows how to conduct elections, and it knows how to conduct them in certain ways, and it conducted them in the way it wanted to this time.
Greg Barrow on the streets of Nairobi, many thanks. And Zambia's former president, Kenneth Kaunda, is having a busy time of it. He appeared in court today to contest a state decision to arrest and detain him. 2 days ago, he was released from jail but put under house arrest on condition that he play no active part in politics and give no media interviews. However, in court today, that wasn't quite the way it worked. We're going now to the capital, Lusaka, and our correspondent, Jeremy Vine. Jeremy, what in fact did Dr. Kaunda say and do in court?
He said a number of things to a number of people. I walked up to him very early on in the day and asked him how he was, and he said he wasn't very happy about his conditions. He thought the conditions he was being kept in under house arrest were very harsh. He then actually stood up because his supporters began chanting, and he told them to keep quiet or they'd be thrown out of the court. And he said, "Our cause is just." Well, that's a clear breach of the condition, which says that he shouldn't speak publicly. And then just before he left the court altogether, he addressed them again in court and said, "Bitter men are known to do bitter things," which was obviously a reference to President Chiluba.
A challenge then clearly for the authorities today in what he said and did. What do you think they in turn will do about it?
At the moment, all that they can do, really, assuming that they don't actually charge him with breaching his conditions of arrest, is keep him in his house. Now, his supporters are saying that they don't expect this court action, which has been generated by Dr. Kaunda, to succeed. So they think the next 3 or 4 days, over next week, when Dr. Kaunda is in court trying to get this order of house arrest lifted, will be unsuccessful. They feel that at the moment President Chiluba doesn't feel safe because of the botched coup attempt in October, and one of his responses to not feeling safe is to keep Dr. Kaunda under lock and key.
So what in fact then is the procedure now? He appears in court during the day and then goes back under house arrest overnight.
Well, the court proceedings have been adjourned. He's seeking bail. He wants to be able to leave his house. And more specifically, he wants to know exactly what the charges are against him, because all he's been told is that he's linked in some way to this 3-hour coup that was over in the morning in October and it resulted in the arrest of some disaffected army officers. He's been told he's linked to it, but he doesn't know exactly what the evidence is. He was out of the country at the time. So he wants to either be set free or to see the evidence. And he'll have an answer to whether he can or not next week.
The government then have given an undertaking that they will in due course produce the evidence on the basis of which he's been arrested.
They have given an indication that they will. Certainly that has been implicit in the President, Frederick Chiluba's words in response to the international outcry that this case has generated. But you have to remember, there is a state of emergency here. And just it struck me just as I walked out of the court. There, on the one hand, were some singing opposition supporters, and on the other were hundreds of armed police officers who were looking at them with some disdain. There is quite a tense situation here in Zambia, and this case is becoming a focus for that tension.
Jeremy Vine in Lusaka, many thanks. And coming up later in the programme, will Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lose his foreign minister from the cabinet and provoke a fresh government crisis? You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Oliver Scott, and you're tuned to NewsHour. And the main news headlines, reports from Kenya say that with most votes counted after the general election, President Moi is poised to retain power. As we just heard, the former president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, has appeared in court to challenge an order placing him under house arrest. And police patrols have been stepped up in Northern Ireland in an attempt to prevent further sectarian killings. 1997 was the year that Europe's poorest country self-destructed. During the first half of this decade, Albania appeared to be emerging from 40 years of isolation, growing more stable and prosperous. Just as important, the Albanian government had important friends in the West. But this year, that image was shattered. A financial scandal involving high-risk pyramid investment schemes led to open revolt and the collapse of law and order. For several months, sizable areas of the country were in a state of anarchy. Our Central Europe correspondent John Devitt reported from Albania during much of the year, and he's recently returned.
It's May 1997. In the central Albanian village of Sirik, about 40 people are crowded into the only cafe. The atmosphere is nervous and highly charged. Everyone has a weapon. Kalashnikov rifles lie on the tables, hand grenades hang from belts, and in the corner a man toys with a laser-guided anti-tank weapon. The cafe is a sort of rebel army HQ, because the day before the villagers had driven out a force of special police sent by the then president Sali Berisha to reassert his authority.
As soon as they came here, they started shooting in the air with machine guns and other stuff.
And
they had six armed APs, two armed cars,
and three
trucks filled with troops.
Outside, the villagers are still shooting over the burnt-out remains of one armoured personnel carrier, where two of the police had been burnt alive. The story of what happened in Sirik is typical of the rest of Albania. Nearly everyone in the village had lost large sums of money in investment schemes that had promised impossible returns. At the turn of the year, the schemes began to collapse, and the Albanians were quick to blame their government and quick to resort to violence. By the end of January, demonstrations had started to get out of control, and in several towns, public buildings were burnt. But when I spoke to President Berisha at that time, he wasn't prepared to accept the blame.
I'm deeply convinced that the Albanian political, economical and stability and financial stability is not at all in danger. No. People profit from liberal standards that are implemented. One thing is sure, in dictatorships and socialism, never you could imagine such schemes.
Such free market talk had always served Mr. Berisha well. It had won him some influential right-wing allies in the West. But to Albanians, it was no longer enough. The fact that the government had done nothing to warn of the dangers or try to close down the schemes added to the growing impression that the state had robbed the people. The arguments of opposition leaders like Neretan Seka began to gain credibility.
The Albanian state is a corporative state. On a fascist model, you must be a member of a party to be a director, to be in secret service, to be in police, to be in the army. So, and state and party is the same thing in Albania.
President Berisha's political credentials were already seriously in doubt after elections in 1996, which had been described by international monitors as crudely manipulated. But in February, even talk of compensation had become largely academic as the country took the law into its own hands. In the southern port of Vlora, where people had been among the first to lose money, the protests became increasingly violent. By the end of February, a new and more deadly element changed the balance of power. On the 28th, people in the town broke into a police armory, seizing weapons. The trend quickly spread to other towns in the south, and as it spread, the government forces melted away. Soon, every police and army base in the area was open to anyone who cared to walk in. Teenagers grabbed sophisticated weaponry. People drove away tanks, and in the port of Saranda, even ships from the Albanian Navy were taken. The prisons were left unguarded. In response, the government imposed a state of emergency and tried to mobilize the army. The military, though, were reluctant to get involved. In reality, President Berisha could only rely on his own special police known as the Sheikh and the Presidential Guard. His threats to retake the South by force turned out to be hollow. In fact, they were counterproductive because they encouraged yet stronger resistance. In the midst of it all, Mr. Berisha had himself re-elected president for another 5 years. But the loyal chants of his faithful began to sound more and more desperate. Eventually, and reluctantly, President Berisha agreed to a new government, including members from the opposition, and called fresh elections. But he still retained control over the powerful Interior Ministry, and he refused to resign. And then, on March the 12th, without warning, the anarchy of the South spread to the capital. Most of Mr. Berisha's former friends in the West had finally had enough.
Inside the US compound in Tirana, an American Marine helicopter lands on one of the few bits of open space. 16 American civilians with their baggage are escorted across the open space towards the open rear door of the helicopter as it touches down.
Along Albania's coast, another exodus was starting. This group of men, sleeping on the beach in Durrës, had come from a town in the north of the country.
Everything is stalled there. Some people, they are killed, you know. Explosive guns and everything. And the worst thing is that the kids, they are using those guns.
Thousands of Albanians tried any means possible to cross the Adriatic Sea to Italy or the mountains to Greece in search of a better life. It finally made the Italians act. Their ambassador in Tirana had been one of the strongest supporters of President Berisha, working behind the scenes to keep him in power. But in April, the Italian government had to take the initiative in organizing a multinational force called Operation Alba. It provided little more than psychological stability. The force went to great lengths to avoid conflict, and it did nothing to try to break the power of the gangs that now ruled in many parts of the country. But it did manage to keep a lid on the number of people fleeing the country, and its biggest achievement was to leave, having hardly fired a single shot in anger. The greatest gamble, though, were elections, organized for the end of June. Before they were held, it was obvious they would fall far short of normal democratic standards. This convoy of cars passing through central Albania was the campaign caravan of the main opposition Socialist Party. They were only allowed to pass with the permission of the armed gangs who controlled much of the country. President Berisha and his party were prevented from campaigning at all in many places. The opposition had a big advantage over previous campaigns. They had a leader, Fatos Nano, an economist, whose reputation had been enhanced by 4 years in prison on charges many believed to be political. In the end, he was able to walk out of jail when the guards disappeared, and President Berisha had little choice but to pardon him.
Well, now it's very simple to make the distinction between a demagogue and a pragmatic politics. That's why this is our chance, at least. We couldn't allow ourselves to repeat his mistakes.
In fact, it was the only chance for the international community as well. A convincing victory for the opposition might provide a peaceful way out. The possibility of President Berisha's Democratic Party winning or even continuing to wield power in coalition would have simply exacerbated the problem, raising the prospect of an open-ended Bosnia-style mission to the country. There simply wasn't that sort of commitment to Albania. The international community wanted out, and the sooner the better. At the end of the day, the gamble paid off. The elections were amazingly trouble-free, and the socialist-led opposition won a sweeping victory. But there followed a few days of high tension as the old order struggled to come to terms with its defeat.
They went in just in front of the Central Election Commission. Were there for 2 minutes saying, King of the King, Fatos Nano, you bastard, you stole our votes.
One man died and several were injured after this protest march in Tirana turned violent. Some of President Berisha's more fanatical supporters, intent on destabilizing the already fragile situation, had tried to hijack the campaign of the man who wanted to be recognized as Albania's monarch, King Lekë. A referendum on restoring the monarchy had been run at the same time as the election. While the would-be king had gained significant support, it wasn't enough, and ultimately his campaign fizzled out and he returned to his home in South Africa. Eventually, President Berisha bowed to the inevitable and resigned. Today, there's a semblance of peace across Albania, but the new government is well aware that the people weren't necessarily voting for them, but rather against the country's previous rulers. The international community have put considerable pressure on Albania's new leaders to avoid the cycle of retribution that may one day come back to haunt the new government. After 4 years in jail, Fatos Nano is now the Prime Minister.
It won't be the duty of the government, not of the parliament, not of the political parties, to condemn or amnesty people, but as a priority, we are cooperating with international specialized institutions to rebuild an independent justice and to help this justice identify who is guilty for what.
The story for now ends where it began, in the village of Serik.
6 months later and I'm in the same cafe. The guns have gone. The only people here are a group of men sitting at a table drinking coffee, negotiating to buy kitchen knives and a hairdryer from two traders. Outside, the burnt-out remains of the armoured personnel carrier have been removed.
In fact, in the intervening months, the cafe was virtually destroyed as the armed people of the village began squabbling among themselves. At least three people were killed over the months as rival gangs turned their weapons on each other. In the end, like nearly everywhere else in the country, the village welcomed the police back. The villagers have kept their weapons for self-defense, although now they're well hidden. They say they still want their money back from the pyramid schemes, but they seem ready to wait.
Cracking.
And there's been a poor response to an amnesty offered by Pakistan's government to people who have defaulted on loans from state banks. Nearly $3 billion are involved, but less than $100 million was repaid by the deadline at the end of December. Roger Harvey of our business staff is here. Roger.
Well, loan default is a major headache in Pakistan, Oliver, which undermines the credibility of its finance sector. The money was provided to industrialists, politicians and landowners through political patronage, and they didn't really expect to have to pay it back. Now, of course, it's got out of hand and the government is threatening to prosecute those involved. Previous threats have come to nothing, so I asked the Financial Times correspondent in Pakistan, Farhan Bakari, what's different now.
This time around, in the last few months, couple of months especially, people have become extremely worried on what could happen if the financial sector collapses, simply because they've seen recent events elsewhere in other parts of the Asian economies, and that is, in a sense, quite a big eye-opener. But being concerned, being worried is one thing, and backing up your concerns with action is quite another, and action is what people will be looking for now.
Currency instability was an early feature of Asia's financial woes 6 months ago, and it continues today, with the Indonesian rupiah plunging about 15%, and the currencies in Malaysia and the Philippines hitting new lows as well. The BBC correspondent in Jakarta, Jonathan Head, explained what's behind those big day-to-day changes.
None of the major traders are touching the currency, but there is a large number of Indonesian businesses who are desperate to buy dollars to help pay back their foreign loans. They simply wait for the rupiah to improve its value. The moment they do, they dive in and buy dollars, sell rupiah, and then the value drops again. It's very much domestically driven, the current trading in the rupiah, and it's very difficult for the Bank of Indonesia to stabilize it.
Well, the US dollar's present trading at 131.6 Japanese yen and at 1 German mark 80. The pound's at $1.63.9. On the Hong Kong share market, the Hang Seng fell 42 points to close at 10,680. Tokyo was closed, and after half a day's trading in London, the 100 share index ended 58 points up at 51.93. That's the finance, Oliver.
Thanks very much, Roger. And coming up now shortly in the programme, is the hard-won ceasefire in Northern Ireland now on the brink of coming to an end? And a Middle East peacemaker in waiting, Gina Lollobrigida. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Oliver Scott, and this is NewsHour. And a summary now of the latest world news, and here's David Ryder.
President Moi of Kenya seems certain to win another term of office after an election marked by allegations of vote rigging. According to unofficial results, based on three quarters of the constituencies, he has a clear lead over his closest rival, a former vice president, Mwai Kibaki. The former Zambian president, Kenneth Kaunda, has appeared in court to challenge an order placing him under house arrest. Defying the terms of the order, Mr. Kaunda also spoke to supporters to deny that he was involved in an attempted coup last October. Police patrols have been stepped up in Northern Ireland after an increase in sectarian attacks, which are threatening the peace process there. The increased security was announced after emergency talks between the British government and local police. Iraq has condemned the naval exercises Turkey is planning to hold with Israel and the United States in the Mediterranean next week. The Iraqi Foreign Minister, Mohammed Saeed Asahaf, described them as provocative and called on all Arab countries to urge Ankara to withdraw from the manoeuvres. The Americans say they have new evidence that Iran is seeking to develop a long-range ballistic missile that could strike targets in Israel, Turkey, and much of the Gulf. They say spy satellites have monitored engine tests for the missile, which they believe could make its first test flight within 2 years. Reports in the West African state of Niger say the former civilian Prime Minister, Hamar Amadou, is among several people arrested in connection with a plot to assassinate the president, Ibrahim Barre Manassara. The police accused Hamar Amadou of being the mastermind behind the plot. And scientists in Hong Kong are carrying out tests to see whether dogs, cats and rats may also be carrying the virus which causes bird flu, the form of influenza spread by chickens. That's the main story at the moment. Now here's Oliver Scott again.
Thanks, David. Ominous signs are emerging from Northern Ireland about the peace process. The police are significantly increasing patrols as fears grow about more indiscriminate gun attacks after the fatal shooting of the loyalist leader Billy Wright in prison. David Trimble, leader of the province's biggest political party, the Ulster Unionists, said there was a real danger now that the Protestant paramilitary's ceasefire would crumble. He said some of the blame for that should be laid at the door of Mo Molem, the British minister responsible for Northern Ireland.
She needs to try and find some way of stabilising society. Obviously, the specific problems with regard to the LVF and, of course, INLA, the Republican group that hasn't been on a ceasefire, whose murder of the LVF leader has been the immediate cause of these things. She's got a security problem to deal with. She's also got a serious political problem to deal with, and that is a diminishing confidence in her and in the peace process amongst loyalists and indeed unionists generally.
The heightened police activity was announced after Mo Molem met the chief constable of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, Ronnie Flanagan. Meanwhile, John Hume, leader of the mainly Catholic SDLP, says it's obvious that those involved in the killings were trying to derail the peace process.
It is the duty of everyone, the politicians in particular, and indeed the two governments, to stand very firm and indeed to reflect what is the will of the vast majority of our people to achieve lasting peace and lasting stability. And the way to do that is to reach agreement at the table. And now that we are at that table with the two governments, we should be very, very steady and not allow these extreme elements to derail us.
John Hume. And as for Mo Molem, she decided to cut short her holiday break to go to Belfast for those talks with the Chief Constable. We're joined now from there by the BBC's Tom Coulter. Tom, do we know what's been said between them?
Well, certainly the meeting lasted for several hours this morning. There were also top political and security advisers to Mo Molem at the meeting. Afterwards, the Chief Constable emerged and said that he had ordered an increase and a topping up of security patrols in the province to try and deal with the threat of the Protestant paramilitary group, the Loyalist Volunteer Force, who have threatened more violence. So there's an increase in patrols on the streets. We'll see more police and soldiers there in an attempt to thwart any further murder bids.
Has she been talking to anybody else, any of the political leaders, for example?
Dr. Molum has, over the past few days, she came back to the province on Monday as well and met security chiefs there. And she has been speaking, whether on the phone or individually. She actually had a meeting with the Ulster Unionist leader that we heard from there a few moments ago, David Trimble, on Wednesday. So she's been keeping in contact with all the political parties who are involved in the inter-party talks process, part of the overall peace process at Stormont. So she's keeping in touch with them, trying to keep them on board, trying to reassure them about the process and that it will work, it will meet all their individual aspirations, and to try and ease our way through this very difficult time.
You say to try to keep them on board. I mean, are there now real fears or dangers that they might walk out of those peace talks, or at least not participate in them anymore?
There is that threat there. One of the smaller parties, the Progressive Unionist Party, which represents one of the Protestant paramilitary groupings, the Ulster Volunteer Force, they have said they have not as yet made up their mind if they will return to the talks, which are due to resume on the 12th of January. The Ulster Unionist Party, David Trimble's party, are also quite unhappy. I don't think that they will walk away at this stage. But if we have any more people leave this process, we have already Dr. Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party and Bob McCartney's UK Unionist Party outside the process. If any others leave it, it's going to damage its credibility completely.
So, given all that at what you might call the political and security level, how's the atmosphere actually on the streets of Belfast and elsewhere in Northern Ireland?
The atmosphere on the streets, I think someone put it to me the other day following the murder of Billy Wright, and this was at his funeral actually, they said there was a sense of foreboding. People are worried now. They have seen two gun attacks on bars and hotels in recent days, and those gun attacks, two people were killed in them. They could have been mass murder in many ways, and people are desperately worried at this moment in time that we are slipping back down that slope into the sort of conflict that we saw some 3-4 years ago before the ceasefires were called. And it is a concern. People are worried, and at this moment in time I think that the Secretary of State is trying to reassure them that the peace process, the talks process, is the way forward. Dialogue is the way to resolve the differences.
Tom Coulter in Belfast, many thanks. It's been called the new great game, the battle to control the flow of billions of dollars of oil from the vast fields of Central Asia. Competing plans exist to build massive new pipelines. But until that happens, most of the oil will have to pass by tanker through the Bosphorus, the waterway which links the Black Sea to the Mediterranean and the world beyond. The Turkish government is worried that an increase in tanker traffic could lead to a major disaster. Our correspondent Chris Morris travelled down the Bosphorus to find out more.
030. On the bridge of the Nilos, a tanker sailing from Italy to Russia to pick up a cargo of crude oil. It's just entered one of the most hazardous waterways in the world. The Bosphorus cuts a narrow channel through the heart of Istanbul, home to 10 million people. With 12 changes of course and hazardous currents, it's never been an easy passage.
This is the breakwater. This is the vessel, which is just in the center of the screen. And the radar antenna is rotating at here.
And Captain Saim Oğuzolgun, who's helped guide ships through the Bosphorus for many years, says a critical point has now been reached.
Daily, around 140, or in a year, around 50,000 different vessels, which is carrying different cargoes, most of them the dangerous cargoes, carriers are passing through the Turkish Straits.
Halfway down the channel, another tanker has run aground, its bow jutting into the air, just a few meters from the waterside villas of Istanbul's elite. The International Convention Governing Navigation of the Bosphorus guarantees free passage during peacetime for vessels of any nation carrying any type of cargo. But the rules were drawn up more than 60 years ago, and local people say it's time for a change.
It's very dangerous, as you can see, and it's not the first time there's been an accident. Can you imagine what it would have been like here with all this oil if there'd been an explosion?
That's exactly what happened 4 years ago when survivors had to be helped ashore after two vessels collided in the night. 29 sailors were killed in the flames as oil fires raged across the surface of the water. The pollution is bad enough. Bayram Ozturk of the Marine Research Foundation says the Bosphorus is dying biologically. But the citizens of Istanbul fear for their own safety as well.
Not only biologically, culturally, one of the big cities of the world. Look at the church, look at this mosque, look at these synagogues. Most of them are seashore. These are the heritage of the civilizations. I don't want to imagine any more collisions in the street. We don't feel that we are safe. We are always feeling that something comes.
And there could be more on the way. Russia wants to increase the number of tankers it sends down the Bosphorus as oil begins to flow from the largest untapped reserves in the world around the Caspian Basin. We've now left the Nilos just before it reaches the wide expanse of the Black Sea. Another tanker has passed safely down the Bosphorus. But another accident in the middle of this old city seems almost inevitable as the race to get Caspian oil to hungry world markets begins in earnest. The rivalry between Turkey and Russia will be played out here on this narrow stretch of water.
Chris Morris reporting there from the Bosphorus. An Irish company is taking a big gamble which could change seafood menus forever. They've set up an eel factory and aim to put between 60 and 200 tons of smoked eels on European and maybe Japanese dinner tables too. It's all easier said than done. Eels don't breed in captivity and need to be caught in their tens of thousands as they make their way up Irish rivers. Declan Duggan of the company, Aqua Arklow, explained how they're helping with the food cycle.
The capture of glass eels or elvers is very strictly enforced in Ireland. Unlike the UK, where there's quite a large fishing industry for elvers on the Severn, for instance, we've got a special licence which is strictly enforced, and the condition of that licence is that we also have to restock on growing eels to continue the cycle as such.
So you put them back in the rivers once they've grown a bit bigger?
Yeah, well, we take them out at 0.3 of a gram and we put back a certain proportion at 10 grams. So therefore they have a much greater survival rate.
In essence then, what you do is fatten the eels up for market.
Exactly.
Where are your markets?
The main market is in Holland and Germany. Japan also is a large market, something like 100,000 tonnes a year.
And how much of a delicacy are eels regarded as being?
In Japan, very much so, in that there's 2 days, I think it's in August, that everyone in Japan eats a little bit of eel to combat fatigue, and it's a long-standing tradition.
How many eels would you typically have on the premises, right this very second, for example?
Probably in the region of 3/4 of a million.
And they can't breed in captivity because they only breed in the Sargasso Sea,
exactly,
is that right?
Exactly.
So how did you get this idea when nobody has had it apparently before?
Well, I think people have had the idea, but I was in the... we had a small company involved in industrial pipe fitting. And a lot of people say to me, well, you're a plumber by trade, what do you do, why are you doing fish? But I mean, basically this is only a big plumbing job. It's all pipe, tanks, pumps. And as I said before, if we keep the water quality right, the eels tend to look after themselves and we don't have any great problem.
How are you doing?
It's looking good at the moment. The first year is very hard in that it's all money going out. It takes between 8 and 16 months for these to reach maturity. So for the first year, you're operating on your bank loan, grants, etc., until you make your first sales.
But from then on in?
From then on in, hopefully everything goes well. It's a relatively high-risk business in that you could be wiped out conceivably. We have backup generators and all that, but basically these are stocked at such a high density, there's very little room for error.
Declan Duggan there. And coming up before we end the programme, is Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel facing a new cabinet crisis, and could he manage without a prospective defector? You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Oliver Scott, and this is NewsHour. And a reminder of the main points in the news. Police in Northern Ireland have stepped up patrols as the British government attempts to prevent further sectarian killings and preserve the peace process. Reports from Kenya say that with most votes counted after the general election, President Moi is poised to retain power. And the former president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, has appeared in court to challenge an order placing him under house arrest. And it's now approaching 13:45 GMT. The high-stakes political guessing game in Israel rolls on. Will Foreign Minister David Levy resign from the government coalition in protest over social spending cuts in the tough austerity budget? A vital parliamentary vote on the 1998 budget has now been postponed until Monday after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was yesterday forced to delay it, and that's the first time in Israeli history such a vote has been put back. Mr. Levy is perceived as a strong advocate of the peace process and heads the Gesher Party, which has five seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Michael Kleine is a Gesher MP too. How does he see the prospects for compromise?
We voted against the government in the preliminary calls of the budget, and we wait to receive an offer from him, because every partner in the coalition got allocations for issues very important for those parties, and Gesher is the only party that actually didn't finish with Netanyahu concerning our demands.
And so do you expect that he will make concessions, or if you like, that he will offer allocations to your party as well?
Our party doesn't need allocations. What we ask is for parts of Israeli society, actually the weaker parts of Israeli society, development towns, the peripheries, and we believe that in a budget of 200 billion Israeli shekels, one can find a few hundred million shekels for helping needy students and developing the peripheries in Israel.
But do you think Mr. Netanyahu will accommodate you?
I guess he has no choice, because also his electorate comes from those parts of Israeli society which Gesher is making requests for and which Gesher is actually representing.
In other words, you think a deal will be struck?
Yes, I am optimistic. I guess Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, is clever enough to realize that he can win a battle without Gesher. He cannot win the war without Gesher.
Mr. Levy, of course, has often threatened to resign. There have been quite a few showdowns with Mr. Netanyahu since the government took office, 18 months ago. Could Mr. Netanyahu by now be getting a bit tired of Mr. Levy?
I guess if he had a choice, he could be tired of Mr. Levy. I don't think he has a real choice. I think he knows it. And all the showdowns you mentioned ended up in Levy receiving what he demanded. So this move is always a successful political move, one must remember.
Do you think that there's anything in the view that the two men are divided partly because Mr. Levy is of Sephardic origins, whereas, of course, Likud is substantially an Ashkenazi party, and that this is the cause of the real division?
I don't think so. I believe that Israeli society has grown up and there's no real difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardi. I'm personally Ashkenazi, member of Gesher, and understand David Levy very well. Sometimes I don't understand Netanyahu.
Michael Kleiner there on the paradoxes of Israeli politics. And so on to sport, musical chairs and Indian cricket. Gordon Farkas with us. Gordon.
Yes, Sachin Tendulkar has been sacked as India's captain. The job has been given back to Mohammad Azharuddin. He stood aside for Tendulkar just 16 months ago. Since then, India's record has been dismal, with just 3 wins in 17 test matches under Tendulkar and only 17 victories in 54 one-day internationals. J.Y. Lele, secretary of the Indian Cricket Board, said the decision had been made to relieve the pressure on Tendulkar's batting form.
We thought that the captaincy burden is bothering his batting also. So we thought that we can utilize him as a batsman at the moment. And he is so young that he can always come back as a captain.
Have you spoken to Sachin Tendulkar?
No, I have not met him because he's not in Bombay at the moment.
So does he know the news yet?
Yeah, he will be knowing the news, because when Azharuddin is named captain, it will be in all papers tomorrow.
Well, Azharuddin will lead the side on a 3-match tour of Bangladesh, which starts later this month. He says that he wasn't expecting the board's decision.
In the afternoon at 1 o'clock, the board secretary, Mr. Lele, called and said, okay, you've been appointed captain, and I said, congratulations. And I said, thank you very much. I was pleasantly surprised, you know.
I mean, Sachin has been through a wretched time, really, with the bat, and marrying that with the captaincy has been a problem. Do you think it'll be a problem for you?
No, I've had, to be frank, I haven't had any problem like this. You know, maybe in one or two series I had very I'm in low scores, but the more responsibly, the better I have done. So hopefully, I think it happens the same way.
Mohammed Azharuddin was talking to David Coles. Well, meanwhile, South Africa's cricketers struggled to 197 for 5 on the first day of the second test against Australia in Sydney. At the close of a slow-scoring day, Hansie Cronje was unbeaten on 56. The South African captain took nearly 4 hours to score his half-century. More interesting events took place off the field, where the match degenerated into a comedy of errors, including the drinks trolley breaking down on the pitch. Alistair Yeomans reports.
Play was delayed for 30 minutes on a beautiful day because groundsmen had excessively watered an area of the square. During the pre-match ceremonies, the national anthem of South Africa had to be interrupted and then repeated when the singer complained he couldn't hear his own voice. To add to the embarrassment, the ground announcer described the tourists as South Australia, and matters descended into near farce when the drinks wagon broke down after a refreshment break in the middle of the ground. Umpire Peter Willey and Australian players Mark Waugh and Glenn McGrath had to push it off the field to howls of laughter from the crowd.
Alistair Yeomans, and that's the sport.
And the sport in turn with Gordon Farker. Japan's cultural capital, Kyoto, is about to acquire a new site for the millions of tourists who visit every year, a French bridge. The idea came from no less a figure than President Jacques Chirac. But many oppose it because they'll pay for it and they haven't been properly consulted about it. From Kyoto, Juliet Hindle.
Visitors ring bells in Kyoto's Kyomizu Temple. It's one of the city's many unmissable sites. Kyoto is Japan's cultural capital and the most popular tourist destination in the country. 40 million visitors descend on the city every year, most of them from Japan. But it's also a modern city and the scene of frequent public battles over town planning. Trains arrive at Kyoto Station. It's just been rebuilt. The new silver-coloured building towers high above the surrounding city. Its size and bold modern design have won it many enemies. Protesters tried to have it stopped, complaining that it was out of keeping with the rest of Kyoto, but it went ahead unchanged. Now a new battle is brewing, here by the Kamo River, which runs through the heart of the city. On one side are nightlife and restaurants, and on the other there are the tea houses of Kyoto's famous geisha, high-class entertainers. Both are traditional parts of historic Kyoto, and they'll soon be joined together by a French bridge. It's the idea of the French president Jacques Chirac. He visited Japan in 1996. He's a fan of Japanese culture, and he suggested building a replica of a 19th century bridge in Paris over the Kamo River. The city authorities immediately accepted. Mark Keane, an American who's lived in Kyoto for more than a decade, thinks it's an absurd idea. As chairman of the International Society to Save Kyoto, he's helped organize a campaign against it.
The bridge project in and of itself is shocking, but it also reveals three things about town planning in Kyoto which are a problem. The first is the great focus on Western traditions as the model for town development. The second is the lack of true citizens' participation in any sort of town planning decisions. And the third is the deep connection between city administrations and construction companies and the pushing forward of construction projects simply to fund construction companies.
After public pressure, the city government has agreed to ask citizens to choose the design of the railings. Hitoji Matsumura works at the Kyoto City Planning Department.
Bringing in new things and introducing them to the city's residents and other people is what Kyoto has always done. We're always embracing new things.
This is just one of the many unofficial discussions about the new bridge, which have taken place throughout the city. One of the things worrying residents is the cost, $6 million of taxpayers' money. But others say that the bridge will bring a welcome boost to the east side of the river. Shizuhiko Ishida runs a sushi restaurant. He says if the bridge makes money flow across the river, it would have a good economic effect. Kiba, a geisha in her 70s, lives on the other side. She's set against the bridge. We have to protect the environment, she says. The bridge is to be built on stone pillars. Traditional Japanese bridges are made of wood. Sean Bisco from Denmark is another long-term foreign resident of Kyoto. He says this could never happen in his hometown.
In Copenhagen, we do a lot to preserve our cultural and historical heritage. And it's completely unthinkable to put in an absolutely alien thing in our harmonious environment.
High in the hills above Kyoto is the Shimyoin Temple. It's located at the source of the river. The chief priest, Shincho Tanaka, is against the bridge plan and fears the spirits of the river will be unsettled. But that's not his main objection.
Basically, I'd be against any bridge because there's no need for a bridge on that part of the river. But why does it have to be Western style? It's our responsibility to leave our own culture behind for future generations.
Kyoto is the home of many of Japan's traditional arts, and it still has more old buildings than almost anywhere else in Japan. But that may change soon. Despite the protests, the city government says the French-style bridge will go ahead. It may cement ties between Japan and France, but it's likely to weaken links with Kyoto's own historic traditions.
Juliet Hindle in Kyoto. Gina Lollobrigida is what? An Italian, a world-famous movie actress, a great beauty of her times. Yes, all of that, and it seems something else too. In 1983, the star-struck Syrian defense minister, General Mustafa Klass, says he gathered all of Lebanon's resistance leaders together when Israel invaded the country and told them they could do whatever they wanted with other troops making up the multinational force. But he said, don't shoot the Italians. He didn't want a tear to fall from her eye. How did she learn of the general's existence?
He wrote me a lot of letters, but I mixed them with the admirer. Then, to be sure that I will read it, he wrote me other letters, but he gave to some politician when they were to Syria, and they bring it personally to me. When they came back, they said, I promised to General Klass that I will give you this letter and also a lot of presents. He gave me a lot of jewelry. So I realized that I had a very persistent, nice, wonderful admirer. Just a few years ago, some industrial of helicopter, Italian, Augusta, they asked me, why you don't come to Syria with us? So I said, why not? So I went there, and the general, when he saw me, he almost fainted.
I'm sure he did, as anybody would, really, when you showed up unexpected on his doorstep. When did you first also realize that you amounted to a peacekeeper, or at any rate, that the guns were not to be trained on Italian troops?
Just now, because this thing that he did, that he saved the Italian soldier for love of me, he said it now. He is very educated, very cultured. He's actually a poet. He wrote a lot of books, and in one big book, there is also my photograph. I must say I'm very popular with Arabs. I don't know why. Probably I am the right type for them. I met also Saddam Hussein. It was a festival in Damascus. And all the other people he put in a hotel. But me, I was instead a guest of the government palace. Alone. Completely alone. You know, perhaps if I'm invited, perhaps I can try to convince him that it's a good thing not to make so much war.
Perhaps.
And to think of the peace. What do you think?
I think you should perhaps mediate between President Clinton and Saddam Hussein. Why
yeah.
not? Gina Lollobrigida there. And so to the end of this edition of the programme. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back, of course, tomorrow. Meanwhile, for now, though, goodbye.